starts tomorrow at 2 until 9 on KQED. All things considered, in just a minute, Julie Depesch returns with an update on the Caldecott Tunnel fire.
Yeah, much better news out here. Both boards are open, eastbound 24, the Caldecott Tunnel. I would say a truck fire happened about 10 o'clock. The fire is out, truck is gone now, but still very slow back to Broadway. It's a stalled dump truck in Richmond, 580 eastbound before Harbor Way. You'll see that in the right lane. And we have a stall in the Santa Cruz Mountains on Highway 17 and southbound after Alma Bridge Road. Look for that blocking the right lane. Julie Depp for KQED.
Afternoon support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport. SFO can make traveling easier with fast Wi-Fi, mobile driver's licenses accepted at security checkpoints, and prepaid parking. More at flysfo.com. Good afternoon. I'm Dave Freeman on member-supported KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands Sacramento. Now 1 p.m.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi appears to have won a third term.
But this time he'll have to share power with coalition partners who may not necessarily share his agenda.
Today is Tuesday, June 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, President Biden rolls out new measures to restrict the number of migrants able to cross the southern border.
I've come here today to do what Republicans in Congress refuse to do. Take the necessary steps to secure our border.
In Ukraine, a music festival opens to a full house even as air raid sirens and explosions boom outside.
And the new movie Ezra stars an actor with autism playing an autistic character.
When we see portrayals like this on film, those things really change the way we're treated in real life. It's important to get these things right.
No news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Biden administration's imposing tighter restrictions on the volume of asylum seekers at the southern U.S. border under an executive order the president signed this afternoon.
If they choose to come without permission and against the law, they'll be restricted from receiving asylum and staying in the United States. This action will help us gain control of our border, restore order into the process. This ban will remain in place until the number of people trying to enter illegally is reduced to a level that our system can effectively manage.
The White House has been under pressure to act in border communities as security struggles are real. The mayor of Sierra Vista, Arizona, Clea McCaw, was among the elected officials who sent the president a letter of appeal to do something.
To paint this environment, we are a safe community, yes, but we have some issues that are related to illegals coming north, endangering our residents and citizens. That issue has been documented in the letter to Congress and the President for them to fully staff our border with a federal law enforcement presence.
Mayor McCaw speaking with NPR's Here and Now. Jurors heard opening statements today in the federal gun trial of Hunter Biden. The president's son is charged with lying about his illegal drug use when he bought and owned a gun in 2018. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
In his opening for the government, Assistant U.S. Attorney Derek Hines told jurors that no one is above the law in the U.S., no matter their family name. He said this trial is taking place because Hunter Biden chose to illegally own a gun when he was addicted to crack cocaine, and that he lied about his drug use on a background check form when buying the gun. In his opening, Hunter Biden's attorney Abby Lowell said his client has been clear about his drug use and addiction. But Lowell told jurors that Hunter Biden had completed a rehab program a month before the gun purchase, and he says Hunter did not knowingly make a false statement when buying the gun, a requirement prosecutors, he says, must prove. After openings, jurors heard from the government's first witness, an FBI special agent. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, outside the federal courthouse in Wilmington, Delaware.
Syrian and Iranian media reporting Israeli airstrikes in the Aleppo area of Syria killed several people yesterday, including an Iranian military advisor. Here's NPR's Peter Kenyon.
Syria's state-run Sana news agency and Iranian media reported the killing. The Tasnim news agency, seen as close to Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, identified the slain military advisor as Saeed Abyar. Iran has kept military advisors in Syria since the country's civil war broke out in 2011. Iran remains an important backer of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
That's NPR's Peter Kenyon reporting. U.S. stocks have ended the day higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 140 points at 38,711. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. A heat wave is sizzling Northern California and parts of the Bay Area with triple-digit temperatures expected. KQED's Ezra David Romero reports.
The National Weather Service forecast temperatures of 100 degrees in parts of Napa and Contra Costa counties. Closer to the coast, meteorologist Nicole Sarment expects bayside highs of up to 90 degrees.
Our heat advisories are in effect until Thursday. We will begin to slightly cool off Friday and into the weekend, but it's still going to be warm.
To stay safe, Sarment lists the usual hot weather precautions. Staying indoors if possible, dressing in light clothing, staying well hydrated, and never leaving animals or children in cars. The state also reminds employers of the responsibility to protect workers from heat illness by providing water, rest, shade, and training. I'm Ezra David Romero, KQED News.
The Oakland Ballers have their first home game tonight in Raimondi Park in West Oakland. The idea for the minor league team was born after co-founder Paul Friedman heard the A's were leaving Oakland.
We want to lead the greatest comeback in the history of sports.
The team renovated the park in record time, just under a year. Its contract with the city includes $1.6 million the team invested in renovations to the park, as well as overseeing the remediation of the lot the team is using for parking. That lot, which was once the site of the state's largest homeless encampment, is slated to eventually be developed into affordable housing. Find more news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Afternoon support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners of KQED. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car or truck is easy. We can arrange to have it picked up running or not in most cases. Invest the funds back into our news coverage. And you can learn more at kqed.org/cars.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. After 6 weeks of voting in which more than 640 million people cast their ballots, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has claimed victory. The election took place amid a deadly heat wave, and it puts Modi on track to lead the world's most populous nation for the third time. But voters appear to have clipped his wings, as NPR's Dia Hadid reports from New Delhi.
Early morning, outside the headquarters of the ruling BJP party, a man waves devotional candles before a life-size cardboard cutout of the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. Modi, we worship you, he chants. The mood, more prayer than party. Modi began these elections vowing to win a supermajority. Critics say he enjoyed a tilted playing field. Much of Indian media cheered him on. Law enforcement agencies froze the accounts of the main opposition Congress party, and they detained one of his main rivals on allegations of kickbacks. Critics say India's Election Commission largely ignored violations of campaigning rules by the Prime Minister, including a ban on inciting communal hatred when at a rally he described India's Muslim minority as infiltrators. Yet as poll workers tallied the results, it was clear the mood had shifted. Modi's party won the largest number of seats in Parliament, but not a simple majority, and not the supermajority he promised. But it was still a victory. Before supporters at the BJP headquarters, he says, on this auspicious day, the NDA will form government for the third time. The NDA is a reference to the coalition that Modi leads, but he's never had to rely on coalition partners before, because in the past two elections, his party won outright. Not anymore.
He's going to have a fairly undignified few years in the chair.
Kapil Komareddy writes on Indian politics, including for The New Yorker. Komareddy says Modi has never had to appease a coalition. He's always projected himself as governing alone, a distant but loving father of the nation. But after losing so many seats...
That is in tatters now.
And Komareddy says the BJP may now question Modi's authority to govern. As the day stretched on, a marching band entertained the crowd. The mood picked up. Nishant Singh served cups of rose-flavoured buttermilk to supporters. In broken English, he says, incumbency is hard.
It is a very difficult for a party. Then he gives the all workers to give the...
And he adds, Modi made history by winning three consecutive terms. The only other Indian leader to have done that was the founder of modern India, Jawaharlal Nehru. On the road, a group of Muslim BJP supporters give celebratory treats to motorists and get scolded by traffic police.
My name is Irfan Mirza.
Not many Muslims support the BJP, but Irfan Mirza says he's celebrating another 5 years of Modi.
Feel very proudly, feel very happily.
But he also seems relieved that the party's majority was curbed. He says the BJP tried to incite against Muslims to whip up their Hindu nationalist base to vote for them. It was an election tactic, he says, and it didn't work. Now the party can focus on what he says is a winning strategy, India's development. As he speaks, it starts to rain, breaking an extreme heat wave that's gripped Delhi for weeks. He says it's a good sign. Dear Hadid, NPR News, New Delhi.
A political revolution is happening in New Jersey today. Democratic primary voters will receive newly designed ballots meant to break the state's long-running political machine. It's the result of a successful legal challenge by Democratic Congressman and Senate candidate Andy Kim, who took on that machine and won. NPR political correspondent Susan Davis reports on how Kim was the right candidate at the right time.
Corruption is so ingrained in New Jersey politics that a May 2023 poll showed as many as 80% of its residents believed its politicians were corrupt. And that was 4 months before Democratic Senator Bob Menendez was indicted for the second time on corruption charges.
I didn't get a single minute of sleep that night. You know, I really felt like I had to do something and really show people that, you know, when there's these problems in our politics that there are people who want to step up and try to fix it.
That's three-term Congressman Andy Kim. He was the first New Jersey Democrat to call for Menendez to resign after his indictment last September. Kim then hastily gathered his political advisors and asked them, what if he ran for Senate instead?
Many of them said, oh, well, look, we can build out a six-week roadmap here. We can have a launch video. We can have a website and a press plan. And I remember just telling them on the phone, like, what would you say if I launched in 3 hours from now?
And he did just that, announcing his Senate bid with a tweet. But New Jersey's Democratic political machine had other plans for the seat. Tammy Murphy, a newcomer but also the wife of Democratic Governor Phil Murphy, jumped into the race weeks later. Her candidacy added a dose of high-profile political nepotism to a primary already shaped by corruption as Menendez refused to drop out. As Murphy was winning endorsements from Kim's fellow Democratic congressman, Kim's campaign was gaining steam on the ground with voters.
I was often 20 points up in the polls, but I was still referred to as the underdog of the race because of this structural problem.
That structural problem is known as the line. Unlike every other state, which lists candidates on ballots by the office they're running for, New Jersey's primary ballots are organized around a slate of candidates endorsed by party leaders that are then presented to voters as a line of names together. Other candidates are placed in columns or rows further away in a place critics refer to as ballot Siberia. One such critic, Julia Sass Rubin, an associate dean at Rutgers University, says the line system, in place since roughly the 1940s, has been extraordinarily successful at electing the preferred candidates of both Democratic and Republican Party bosses.
It provides a double-digit advantage to candidates consistently over a period of 20 years, I found.
In February, Kim filed a lawsuit challenging that ballot design. In March, Murphy surprisingly dropped out of the Senate race after her campaign lagged as Kim scored upset victories in local Democratic county conventions. And then in April, Kim won in court. A federal appeals court upheld a preliminary injunction that bars the use of the line balloting system in today's Democratic primary. Professor Rubin was an expert witness in the case, and she described its impact this way.
It's an absolute earthquake for the state because the county line has allowed a handful of people, really a handful of men, to make all the decisions for the state. If you can control who gets elected to political office, you can control everything.
In a matter of weeks, Kim went from long shot to presumptive nominee, who is now well positioned to win in November. Menendez does plan to run as an independent, but New Jersey hasn't elected a Republican to the Senate in over 50 years. Kim's successful campaign to beat the old system has earned him begrudging respect from some party elders who long supported it, like Congressman Bill Pascrell, who served in Jersey politics for about as long as the 41-year-old Kim has been alive.
This is the segue. This is how we get to the next generation. It is what it is. I'm not going to cry over it.
In many ways, Rubin says, Kim was the right candidate at the right political moment.
He definitely had the right framing for people to believe that he is a reformer, and he was willing to take that risk and go up against the system.
Part of that framing comes from a photograph of Kim that went viral after rioters trashed the Capitol on January 6th. It shows the congressman down on his hands and knees in the rotunda picking up trash. He says he received thousands of letters from Americans moved by that show of decency.
After January 6th, people asked me, are you going to continue to be in politics? Are you going to do this? And I said, yes, I'm actually going to now dedicate my life to trying to solve and address one singular question, which is, how do we heal this country?
Kim admits he doesn't really know all the answers to that question. But if elected to the Senate this November, it won't involve towing the party line. Susan Davis, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli troops withdrew from the Jabalia refugee camp in North Gaza last week. The three-week offensive forced tens of thousands of Palestinians to flee. As Hadil El-Shalchi reports, some are now returning to see what's become of their homes. And a warning, this story includes graphic descriptions of the aftermath of war.
Amin Abed is from Jabalia, a place once densely populated and that saw some of the fiercest fighting during the war. He says the attacks were intensely horrific, with shelling, bombs, and snipers. So Abed packed up his family and fled west. And after weeks of displacement, it was time to go back home to Jabalia last week. I walked on foot half of the way home, he says. Then I found a donkey cart and rode it the rest of the way. But Abed didn't find much there. The scene was frightening, he says. My house was rubble, the doors and windows blown out, and Abed says the neighborhood was terrifying. The corpses he saw on the street were charred, he says, being eaten by dogs. I personally had to collect the remains of my uncle and cousin in a bag, he says. Their bodies were burned by the sun. The Israeli military is expanding its operations across Gaza, and Palestinians say they feel like nowhere is safe. It was a miracle we were able to escape, Abed says. The Israeli military went back to Jabalia 4 months after originally withdrawing. It said Hamas had regrouped there. In that same mission, the military said that it had recovered the bodies of 7 hostages taken by Hamas on October 7th. With more than one operation in Jabalia so far, Abed says who knows if there won't be another. Of course we're afraid of another attack, he says. Israeli military believes that a good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Ramallah.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Afternoon support for KQED comes from UC Santa Cruz, where researchers discovered how often sea otters, a threatened species, use tools when feeding to survive in a rapidly changing environment. More at ucsc.edu. Berkeley Repertory Theater presenting Galileo, a new rock musical starring Raul Esparza as the rebel astronomer from the minds behind Spring Awakening and TV's Empire. Playing through June 16th. BerkeleyRep.org.
I'm Amna Nawaz. On the next NewsHour, why some universities are returning to standardized testing in their admissions process. That's Tuesday on the PBS NewsHour.
And that's just one story. Other developing news. Get the latest on the way at 3 today.
Long lines, cramped seats, endless fees, and canceled flights. You're surprised because why?
We have less competition now than we did under the regulated system.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the flight deck, we're going to have to go back to the terminal. Thanks for your patience. That's next time on Marketplace.
Hopefully you have a little patience left. You can catch Marketplace later this afternoon at 4 p.m. and again at 6:30 on KQED.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on Political Breakdown, Eleni Kounoulakis is the first woman elected lieutenant governor in California. Now she's aiming for the top rung, running for governor in 2026 after Gavin Newsom is termed out. She joins us to talk about that, the new abortion super PAC she's launched, and what she'd like to do as governor. It's Political Breakdown today at 5:50 on KQED Radio.
More stories at kqed.org. Cal Matters looks into AI use in the classroom. Teachers are using AI to grade papers, but who's evaluating the AI? Find the story and all of our news coverage at kqed.org. Support for NPR this afternoon comes from Easy Cater, committed to helping companies from nonprofits to the Fortune 500 find restaurants that cater meetings and events, with online ordering and 24/7 live support. Learn more at easycater.com. Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED Public Radio.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ezra Bernal is a pretty fantastic 10-year-old. His dad, Max, is a New York comedian, so Ezra knows a good punchline. When Max gets a shot at the big time, Ezra has thoughts.
I just got off the phone with Aunt Jane. Turns out Jimmy Kimmel wants me to be on his show in Los Angeles.
That's far.
When it comes down to it, though, Ezra's got his dad's back.
Where am I going to get my mojo from?
Mojo Mom.
That's right. Good.
Ezra is played by William Fitzgerald, and they both, actor and character, have autism. Max, played by Bobby Cannavale, hasn't quite figured out what that means for their life together. The movie is called Ezra. It's directed by Tony Goldwyn. And when I talked with producer Alex Plank and screenwriter Tony Spyridakis, Spyridakis told me the story comes from his own life with his son, Dimitri.
I didn't know what autism was, and so when the diagnosis came, he was only 4 years old. Things happened, you know, I was called to a birthday party where I dropped him off, and they were playing musical chairs, and he didn't get a chair, and that was the end of that party. I mean, I had to get called back to the house and take him out, and then the person at that party had suggested that I have him evaluated. So the whole journey of learning who my son was based on his autism, it was the dad, me, who really needed to be educated.
I'm hoping you can talk a little bit more about the on-set dynamics, Alex. As I understand it, everyone involved with the film took part in an autism education session. Can you talk a little bit about the things that you all did to make it an accessible set?
We looked at over 100 kids, many of whom had never acted before, and we watched tapes, and William's tape came in, and it was really good, so we had a chemistry read, and I was just looking through my notes here, and and the first two lines say, he stims like me, and this is the guy. So, you know, we were really lucky to find William. But in terms of providing a good experience on set for him and creating a movie that I think was authentic and true to life and respectful of autistic people, and because really, when we see portrayals like this on film, those things really change the way we're treated in real life. You know, it's important to get these things right because there's so little portrayals of us, and generally they aren't portrayed by autistic actors. And then after that, I did a training right before we started filming, and all the department heads came, and I just went through all the sort of situations that could arise on set and how to be respectful of William, how to treat sensory issues right. There's just so many things that went into it. And I think that in reality, what happened was by doing that, it actually made a much more positive set environment for everyone.
I want to talk a little bit more about William Fitzgerald because, I mean, he is a first-time actor and this role is a big lift. He's funny and he's emotional. And in the film, we watch him go line for line with this incredible cast of industry veterans. I'm curious, for either of you, are there ways in which the script changed, in which the character changed once you found William and started working with him as Ezra?
There wasn't much that needed to be changed at all because he was the type of humor that he had, the type of speaking without a filter, that was what Dimitri was when he was 11. And it was what made the script sort of vibrant. And he was not as perhaps inappropriate as my son was, but he had instincts at certain points where he would improvise something and all of a sudden it was just explosively funny. And then there was my Dimitri, right? Because that was where this whole thing started. It was the things that my son did that got him into trouble that I thought were extremely kind of brilliant and out of the box and spot on in some ways. And so what Tony Goldwyn did, which was so wonderful, is that he allowed William to be William. And that's what we all did. And that's everything that Alex represents. And that's everything that the film represents. It's not about changing or fixing your child. It's about letting him be or she be who they are.
And I would just add that one of the things that I really loved about him from the very start is he was just so passionate about his interests, right? Like, people who are autistic have special interests. I certainly do, and I will not shut up about them, and he's the same way. I was invited over to his house by his parents, and we spent about an hour watching YouTube videos about the history of the Civil War and world history, and he's just so passionate and filled with joy. And I think that you see that in the stimming, you know, because stimming is not just, oh, I'm overwhelmed. It's also, I'm excited about this thing I'm talking about. And, you know, I think that when we got on set, one of the things that I really pushed William to do was bring his own spin to things, because I think that's why his character resonates so much with people, because it's authentic and it taps into something that's true to who he is in a way, and who we all are in a way.
One of the things that stuck with me in this film was the scene where Max is really just grappling with the choices he's made and how he can best show up for his son. And he says, I don't want him in his own world. I want him in this world. And I know a lot of people have written about that moment, but it really just has stayed with me. Can either of you say more about that?
This is sort of as much lightness and joy as there is in the film. That's the core pain. When you write from a really good, deep place, you are going to have to share stuff that's super private and super painful. And I think that line is everything I had to overcome. I wanted him in this world. Well, the journey for Max is, you can't have that, maybe. It's his world and your world.
And I think that's also something that we as autistic people go through, you know, in sort of a different way, in that we want to be like everyone else. And then my journey with that was that realizing that, like, I don't want to be like everyone else. I want to be like myself. And I think that this movie really explores that in a way that I think will make people think about, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't be trying so hard to be something I'm not.
For each of you, what do you hope that people will take away when they see this film?
For me, the biggest thing that I hope, and I'm already seeing people take away, is that there is finally a movie where I can see myself on screen. I've gotten so many messages from autistic people who watch the film who are in tears sometimes because they finally seen something where they feel represented and feel seen and heard and understood.
Yeah, that's what I love. I think that as much as it does that for the autism community, I also have to say that it's the parents of that community that's also so well represented in this film. The things that I get are very much from fathers who come up to me and just sort of cry, and you know, we just kind of hug each other, and it's just like hardly words need to be shared. But it's been an overwhelming amount of mail that I get from parents and family who are just so happy to see something represented where you can do the wrong thing, but the right thing can happen because of love.
Tony Spyridakis and Alex Plank, their new movie is Ezra, in theaters now. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from SF MoMA, welcoming music lovers to celebrate 100 years of music and design. Art of Noise features over 800 works from rock posters to hi-fi listening experiences. On view now, more at sfmoma.org. Summitry, offering wealth management engineered for life in the Bay Area, celebrating 20 years of helping clients maximize opportunities like concentrated stock positions and RSUs. More at summitry.com. Along the coast, beach hazard statement starting tomorrow through Thursday. That's the cool place to be right now on this Tuesday afternoon. Highs in the mid-60s. You want the heat? Go inland. Upper 90s are forecast today. Sacramento even hotter. Warm to hot. Highs 97 to 103. An excessive heat warning now in effect until Thursday. Look for some hot gusty winds. 30 miles per hour this afternoon. Hotter temperatures tomorrow. Good afternoon. It's 1:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, the show must go on. Kharkiv, Ukraine holds its annual music festival in the middle of a war.
I asked maybe 20 or 30 different musicians whether they could imagine to come to Kharkiv and to perform here. 99% of them said no.
First news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Biden is taking steps on his own to curb the influx of asylum seekers showing up at the southern border. Biden says he's moving past Republican obstruction to address the issue. Like his predecessor, Biden is using his executive authority in a series of actions, including temporarily shutting down the border if the average daily number of migrants hits 2,500. Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona says while it's not an ultimate solution, it will help ease the burden on Border Patrol agents for now.
This is going to add more Border Patrol agents, fentanyl detection machines, judges, facilities at the border. All the things that many of us have been asking for years. And the fact that that fell apart is, you know, the White House found itself in a situation that it's got to act unilaterally.
The White House is also pressing Congress to provide more resources to process asylum claims quicker. Wisconsin's Attorney General has filed charges today against three people involved with the state's 2020 fake elector scheme. NPR's Stephen Fowler tells us this marks the fifth state where criminal charges have been filed over an alleged attempt to overturn Donald Trump's loss in the election.
The three men charged in Wisconsin, attorneys Kenneth Chesbro and Jim Troupas, and former Trump campaign operative Mike Roman, each face one count of felony forgery. The alleged plot to have swing state Republicans meet and claim to be official presidential electors occurred in seven states following the 2020 election. Now, charges have been filed in five of those states, Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, Georgia, and now Wisconsin. Chesbro has already pleaded guilty to charges in Georgia. Roman also faces charges in two other states. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR. Today marks 35 years since the Chinese army crushed pro-democracy protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Hundreds and possibly thousands of people were killed in the crackdown, but as NPR's John Ruwitch reports, public commemorations remain forbidden.
The anniversary passed quietly in China, with reports of heightened security in the heart of the capital and elsewhere. In Hong Kong, witnesses reported seeing a few people in a downtown district being questioned by police and led away, including one elderly man with a sign. The Hong Kong Free Press, an independent news outlet, said some people were even stopped for having their mobile phone lights on, with police apparently suspicious that they were attempting to make a political statement. Until recently, Hong Kong was home to a huge candlelight vigil each year on June 4th. But since 2020, authorities have used new national security legislation to snuff out dissent and quash political opposition. John Ruwitch, NPR News.
Here in Los Angeles, the former interpreter for L.A. Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani has pleaded guilty today to bank and tax fraud charges in a sports betting case. Ipe Mizuhara admitted he stole nearly $17 million from Ohtani to pay off gambling debts. Baseball fans in the U.S. and Japan were shocked when the news broke 3 months ago. Authorities say there was no evidence Ohtani was involved or aware of his interpreter's gambling addiction. Mizuhara could face more than 30 years in prison. This is NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. Sutter Health, from 34 joint replacement centers to 5 cardiovascular surgery centers, Sutter never stops helping patients get back on their feet. Learn more at sutterhealth.org.
Inside the halls of the Pentagon, some officials are critiquing U.S. policy in Gaza, even resigning in protest. Harrison Mann is one of them. The former Army major speaks openly about the U.S. role in Gaza. Next time on The World.
One of the stories ahead at 2, other developing stories on KQED on The World at the top of the hour. Support for NPR comes from Spiegel & Grau, publisher of Cheaper, Faster, and Better, How We'll Win the Climate War by climate activist and investor Tom Steyer, offering answers and optimism in the fight against climate change. Available at bookstores everywhere. Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And by the listeners, members, and generous sustaining members of KQED Public Radio.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Biden took sweeping executive action today aimed at cracking down on illegal crossings at the southern border.
I've come here today to do what the Republicans in Congress refuse to do, take the necessary steps to secure our border.
The new steps will allow Biden to shut the border to asylum seekers when there are surges in numbers of people trying to get across. Now, this comes just a couple of weeks before his first debate with former President Trump. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is covering the presidential campaign. He is here with us now to talk about the politics of all this. Hey, Franco.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, tell me more. This executive order, how does it work in a nutshell?
I mean, this is a move that's long been expected. And what it'll mean is that when there are 2,500 people a day trying to cross the border unlawfully, the system effectively will shut down. And that's a threshold that they're already seeing. So the new restrictions are expected to start right away. And it won't reopen until the daily numbers fall below 1,500.
And just to point out, this is very similar to what the bipartisan group of senators were trying to get done earlier this year.
That's right. I mean, Republicans pulled out of that bipartisan agreement that would have taken many of the similar steps. And polls do show that Americans see this issue as one of the biggest problems of the day. And most Americans actually don't approve of the way that Biden is handling the border. The Biden administration, though, says that they had no choice to do this after the Republicans backed out of that deal. And here's Biden again, actually.
So today, I'm moving past Republican obstruction and using the executive authorities available to me as president to do what I can on my own to address the border.
Okay, I want to note we're saying Republicans backed out of that deal. That was largely led by Trump, who undercut that previous deal because of politics, which prompts me to ask you, how much of Biden's motivations here are political?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And I mean, I think today what really struck me is how Biden jumped right into the politics of this and blamed Republicans for what he described as a border crisis. I mean, we are entering crunch time for the election. The first debate is weeks away. Early voting starts in September. I mean, this is one of Biden's biggest political vulnerabilities. And it's really not just Republicans attacking him. I mean, when he made that announcement in the East Room of the White House, he was surrounded by mayors and governors, including some Democrats who have been raising concerns and pushing him to get tougher on the border.
Yeah. So who is he trying to reach with this message?
I mean, this is an issue that's no longer just a concern for border states. I mean, I kind of noted that this is a concern in cities cities and towns, hundreds of miles from the border, including in the important battleground states that are going to decide this election. I spoke with Ben Tolchin, a Democratic pollster. He says voters are paying attention right now.
President Biden has a real tough fight for re-election on his hands, and he's got to convince voters in swing states that he's taking border security seriously. If you think about the battleground states of Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, or Nevada and Arizona, immigration and border security matters.
And he pointed out that this is a particular concern among suburban voters in those states for people who are concerned about crime and border security.
Let me ask you about reaction to this executive order. What's the Trump campaign saying?
The Trump campaign's calling it toothless. They're saying Trump is much tougher. They're pointing to some of the exceptions in the measures, such as for unaccompanied minors. And there are some real challenges for Biden, such as the lack of resources at the border. That said, these are some of the toughest measures by a Democratic administration.
And briefly, what about reaction from immigration groups, advocacy groups?
I mean, Biden is getting attacked from both sides. I mean, these are plans that are kind of out of Trump's playbook. Trump tried to use this same authority, and they were sued by the ACLU. And the ACLU told me that they plan to sue again.
Hmm. NPR's Franco Ordonez reporting from the White House. Thank you.
Thank you.
The songwriter and producer known as The Dream is behind some of the biggest chart toppers of our time. He frequently collaborates with artists like Beyoncé, Rihanna, and Mariah Carey. Well, today, one of his former protégés filed a lawsuit accusing him of violent abuse while he promised to make her a star. We'll note that this report from NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Tsiolkas includes descriptions of physical and sexual assault over the next few minutes. Hi, Anastasia.
Hi there, Ari.
The Dream is really well known in R&B music, less so in the public eye. For folks who are not familiar with him, why is he so important?
Well, he's a singer, songwriter, and producer. More than anything, The Dream's a major hit maker. Beyoncé, for example, has collaborated with him on every one of her albums since 2008. He's a songwriter and producer on some of her big hits, including Single Ladies and Break My Soul. And he's won 8 Grammy Awards. In this lawsuit, though, the woman, Shahnaz Mangro, alleges The Dream promised to make her just as big as Beyoncé and another of his collaborators, Rihanna. And I'll note he's being sued under his legal name, which he recently changed from Tarius Nash to Tarius Castile Diamant.
Can you tell us more about the lawsuit, the woman who filed it, and what's alleged?
Sure. She is a singer and songwriter from the Netherlands. She filed the suit in California in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles. And she alleges while The Dream was making extravagant promises about stardom, he pressured her for sex almost immediately. And in the suit, she says he told her sex with him was, quote, part of the process. And so she's accusing him of raping her, violently assaulting her on multiple occasions, including strangling her, forcing her to drink alcohol, and psychologically manipulating her. She alleges he forced her to tell him where she was at all times, and that he allegedly made a video of one of their sexual encounters and then threatened to show it to other people. And she says he told her all the while that this was the path to a huge career.
When does she say this happened?
So she says one of his associates reached out to her in very late 2014 and that she met him in person in January 2015. And she alleges the abuse began almost immediately and continued for months. So this is like a decade ago, right? But her lawsuit cites California's Sexual Abuse and Cover-Up Accountability Act, which specifically allows people to file suits on sexual assault accusations, even if the statute of limitations has expired on the alleged incidents.
Has there been any response from The Dream or his lawyers?
Not to NPR, no, though, of course, we've asked for comment, but a spokesperson of his told The New York Times in a statement, quote, these claims are untrue and defamatory, and that, quote, I am deeply offended and saddened by these accusations. And I should point out that Mangro's suit is also against the record label Epic Records, which is part of Sony Music Entertainment. Mangro says they knew about but ignored the abuse. And she's also suing a company co-owned by The Dream. We haven't heard back from either Epic Records or The Dream's representative. So I think it's going to take a while to see how this all plays out.
All right. That is NPR's Anastasia Tsiolkas. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you for having me, Ari.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. New Mexico is one of the last states to hold a presidential primary this year. So today, with the nominees for both major parties essentially locked up, voters in the land of enchantment have turned their focus farther down the ballot. Reporting from Albuquerque, we are joined by NPR politics reporter Ben Giles. Hey, Ben.
Hey there.
All right, so take us way down the ballot. What races are people there in New Mexico watching today?
Well, most of the action today is at the legislative and local levels. Every seat in the State House and Senate is up for grabs this year. I spoke with voters in Albuquerque and in southern New Mexico. Republicans, Democrats alike, they all say there's hope in a strategy to get voters engaged early to ensure they stay engaged come November. For instance, Republicans in Bernalillo County, that's home to Democratic-leaning Albuquerque, they were abuzz because they have contested GOP primaries for some House and Senate races at the legislative level. That's a first for them. In the past, they say it's been a struggle to get Republicans to run at all in some of those races, but those races are attracting the attention of Republican voters, and they hope that attention will stick.
This is interesting because we hear a lot about candidates down the ballot riding the coattails of presidential contenders. You are saying there's hope that maybe enthusiasm for these down ballot races will trickle up?
That's right. And that hope is also on the Democratic side as well. I spent some time this weekend in Las Cruces where volunteers were knocking on doors for Congressman Gabe Vasquez in southern New Mexico. Vasquez narrowly defeated former Representative Yvette Harrell in 2022. Their rematch this fall is garnering a lot of attention. Now, no one's running against Vasquez for the Democratic nomination, but he and his volunteers, like Rita Treviz, said it was still important to start engaging voters now, even in uncontested races, rather than wait until November. And Treviz had a message for Democrats who might be lacking in enthusiasm, especially at the top of the ticket.
And I hope people understand that instead of pout, you know? Somebody said, just get on the bus. It may not take you exactly to the Garden of Eden, but if it gets you closer to there, take the bus. And Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are a limo for me.
Clearly, yeah. She's a big supporter of the Democratic presidential ticket, but she's also discouraged by a lack of enthusiasm, even among some strong Democrats. I spoke with another young Vasquez volunteer who said he cast an uncommitted vote in the Democratic primary.
I'm tempted to ask you more about limos in the Garden of Eden, but instead I will ask, where does that leave Trump? I mean, if young voters in New Mexico are dissatisfied with Biden, might Trump be trying to pick them up?
Sure, but it's not necessarily a clean trade. We are seeing a lot of that at the national level, these so-called double haters who view both Biden and Trump unfavorably. Daphne Orner is the vice chair of the Bernalillo County Republicans. I asked her if GOP messaging is resonating with young voters there. She said yes, particularly in the wake of Trump's criminal conviction last week.
When the verdict came down on Trump, they're saying, okay, I've had enough now. But to get them active in doing anything, the majority of our party is kind of what you see in this room. We're no spring chickens.
And in that room, Daphne was referring to the county GOP headquarters. It was full of a handful of mostly older volunteers. So it's maybe not picking up steam, but they're hoping it will. There's definitely an effort to use the Trump conviction to activate a new generation of Republican voters here.
That is NPR's Ben Giles reporting from Albuquerque. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from the San Mateo County Fair, featuring new this year Great American Duck Racing, along with the Toytopia exhibit, carnival rides, food, and concerts, June 1st through the 9th. For tickets, visit sanmateocountyfair.com. Landmark College, offering academic and social coaching support for neurodivergent individuals at the Bay Area Success Center. Learn more at landmark.edu/successcenter.
On the next Fresh Air, MSNBC host Ali Velshi talks about his ancestors' migrations from a village in India through South Africa, Kenya, and Canada. One of the figures in the story is Mahatma Gandhi, who knew Velshi's grandfather and had a powerful influence on the family. Velshi's new book is called Small Acts of Courage. Join us.
Tonight's Fresh Air, catch it at 7 on KQED. Tomorrow morning,
the big man from Brooklyn, Fat Joe, is not just a rapper, he's also a healthcare activist.
So this is something that's very bipartisan, and it's something that affects all of the American people.
In our series, We the Voters, Fat Joe tells us why he started campaigning for cost transparency in healthcare. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition at 2 until 9 a.m. and then stay tuned tomorrow morning for Forum.
Coming up tomorrow on Forum with guest host Leslie McClurg, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie were as much a part of American culture as Coca-Cola and Mickey Mouse, says Larry Tye, author of a new biography of the three men. Known worldwide for their pioneering compositions and arrangements, Armstrong's, Ellington's, and Basie's popularity among white audiences would ultimately lay the foundation for the civil rights movement. Tye's new book is called The Jazzmen. Join Forum at 10 a.m. here on KQED.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Attorney General Merrick Garland appeared on Capitol Hill today for a contentious oversight hearing. Republican lawmakers grilled him about the Justice Department's treatment of former president and current presidential candidate Donald Trump. And Garland pushed back against what he called improper attacks on the institution he leads. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson followed the hearing. Hey, Carrie.
Hey there, Ari.
The justice system is under a lot of stress right now, and so is the attorney general. What was the tenor of this hearing in the Republican-led Judiciary Committee today?
Let's step back for a second. This is really a remarkable moment. Just 4 days ago, a New York jury convicted Donald Trump for falsifying business records. And today in Delaware, a federal jury heard opening statements in a gun case against the sitting president's son, Hunter Biden. And in the middle of all of this, Merrick Garland showed up for a regular oversight hearing before the House Judiciary Committee. He basically said he's sick and tired of people advancing bogus conspiracy theories and making threats against his agents and prosecutors.
I will not be intimidated, and the Justice Department will not be intimidated. We will continue to do our jobs free from political influence, and we will not back down from defending democracy.
Well, Kerry, Republicans have been saying for a long time that they believe the Justice Department has been weaponized against them and against Donald Trump. What did those lawmakers say to Garland today?
Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida asked a lot of questions today about the state prosecution of Trump in New York. He focused on how a Justice Department official right here in D.C. went on to work for the Manhattan District Attorney and became part of the team that won the 34 felony convictions against Trump. But the Attorney General Merrick Garland said he had absolutely nothing to do with that.
We do not control the Manhattan District Attorney. Manhattan District Attorney does not report to us. The Manhattan District Attorney makes its own decisions about cases that he wants to bring under his state law.
And another lawmaker, this time a Democrat, pointed out the Justice Department is prosecuting several prominent Democrats, Hunter Biden, Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, and Representative Henry Cuellar of Texas, too.
And while this hearing was going on, Donald Trump went on social media and made some allegations about the Justice Department search of his Florida property where classified documents were found. Tell us more about what's at stake there.
Trump and his allies have been pointing to language about that search of Mar-a-Lago to claim that federal agents were prepared to use deadly force against him. But the Attorney General told Congress that's both dangerous and false. Merrick Garland says that language is standard operating procedure, basically a routine matter every time the FBI conducts a search. Former FBI agents have said the same language was in place when the FBI searched President Biden's home for classified documents as part of a different investigation that ended with no criminal charges.
And this is the same committee, as you've reported, that voted along party lines last month to hold the Attorney General in contempt over the investigation into President Biden. What is the latest on that?
Republicans want audio tapes of the interview Biden did with the prosecutor, and the Justice Department has turned over written transcripts, but Biden has asserted executive privilege over the tapes. The Attorney General says there's no need for those tapes because Congress already has the transcripts, but Republican leaders in the House are mulling whether they have enough votes to hold Garland in contempt. Media and conservative groups have sued for those tapes too, but it's not at all clear they will get them before the presidential election in November.
NPR's Carrie Johnson. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, is the country's artistic heart, and that is especially true for classical music. Despite weeks of Russian strikes on the city, a conductor and his orchestras refused to cancel their music festival. NPR's Joanna Kakissis sends us this postcard from Kharkiv.
It's a few days before the big performance, and 17-year-old Varvara Kasyanova is rehearsing with the Kharkiv Children's Orchestra, where she's principal violinist. Despite the war, she says, the musicians have come together, making what she calls magic.
I've performed at music competitions and concerts since first grade. It's so important to share music with an audience.
The musicians are practicing Ukrainian Suite, a piece by American composer Quincy Porter. They're at Kharkiv's Opera Theater, but not on its sprawling and majestic stage. They're in a small, dark room several floors underground.
Because of the attacks, I am very worried. So is my family. But I live close to the subway, and so the way to rehearsals is also underground.
Conducting the young musicians is Vitaly Alexeyanuk. He's the artistic director of the annual Kharkiv Music Festival. And he also conducts the festival's professional orchestra, which has been shrinking in size since the war began.
Before the war, there were, I think, 10, 15, 20 bassoonists, and now we have zero bassoon players.
What happened to them?
They all left. We don't have tuba player because 3-4 days before the rehearsal start, he was mobilized, so he was enlisted. He's somewhere, I don't know where exactly, but now he's going to fight.
We talk at a nearby park after rehearsal. Alexeyanuk is originally from Belarus, but has lived in Germany for several years. He came to Kharkiv just for the festival, as musicians from Europe and the U.S. used to do before the war.
I asked maybe 20 or 30 different musicians whether they could imagine to come to Kharkiv and to perform here for our festival. 99% of them said no.
A phone app alert warns of yet another attack.
Attention, increased air threat in your area. Proceed to the nearest shelter.
Have you noticed that not a single person has gotten up to leave? Did you look around?
Yeah. It's always like that.
The conductor soon returns underground to the musicians who are preparing for another rehearsal. The Kharkiv Opera Theater was damaged in a Russian attack early in the war, so its leaders created what they call an arts fortress in the corridors and spaces under the building. Ihor Tuluzov is the Opera Theater's artistic director.
We
only use the main stage occasionally for rehearsals in between air raid alarms, he says. But we must hold events in the safest place, the bomb shelter. The festival begins. Concert goers are dressed up, but they must go through security and follow a labyrinth of corridors to reach the wartime stage. The orchestra of adults performs first, and a violin solo brings the audience to tears. A couple of days later, the children's orchestra is on stage with a piano solo playing to a full house. Outside are air raid sirens and explosions, but here, there is only music. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kharkiv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. Your part-time controller, U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services, yptc.com/NPR. And the NPR Wine Club, where members can explore wines from around the world, and every purchase supports NPR's high-quality journalism. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And by the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED Public Radio.